There you go. Okay, so this is intro to Judaism. So people take it for all sorts of reasons. In the case of both of you, it's potentially towards conversion. Typically when we, I'm just gonna grab a marker real quick second. Typically when we talk about Judaism, there's three very broad topics that almost everything we learn falls under. You know, I've heard one person call it the Holy Trinity of Judaism, except Judaism's not known for having a trinity. but if it was, the Holy Trinity would be God as one area, Torah as a third, as a second, and Israel as the third. So when we break it down, we could say an intro to Judaism course would cover something about Jewish belief. What is it? What are the beliefs, both about God, but also just beliefs about humanity, beliefs about what the world is like, belief about whatever. Torah, which could mean all sorts of different things. Jewish, literally the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, but it could also be something beyond that. All of Jewish literature or teaching could be considered Torah. In fact, the word Torah literally means teaching. It shares the same root, and when you start to learn Hebrew, you'll notice that Hebrew is a language where everything has a root that means something, and you can connect words based on the roots of the word, more so than English, much more so than English. So it shares a root with the word for parent, and it shares the root for the word teacher. So teacher, parent, and Torah, whatever Torah is, it shares a root, and the root has something to do with teaching.
Is, so you're referring to Torah as like five books of Moses, five books, and then the writings afterwards. Is that mainly like a more of a reform thing? Like
no, not at all.
It's generally.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, no. I will point out when I'm saying something that's very particular to the reform movement, but this isn't it. The word Torah, it's hard because it's both a proper noun. It means something very specific, such as the first five books of the Hebrew Bible. Occasionally, it can also mean, and it's an overlapping definition, but it could mean specifically one of the scrolls, too. Although, you can have it in a book format. So the Torah doesn't have to be in scroll form, but it can be in scroll form and for ritual purposes. For worship services, it's in a scroll format. So it could be the first five books. It could be the entire Hebrew Bible. So the Hebrew Bible doesn't end with the conclusion of Deuteronomy, which would be the fifth book. The end of the fifth book, Moses dies. The Israelites are just about to cross over the promised land after having wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. The Hebrew Bible continues on. Next comes the book of Joshua, and they actually go in, but under Joshua, not under Moses, because Moses is dead. And it continues on, and you get stories of the kings of Israel, King Saul, King David, King Solomon. You get the stories of prophets, so Elijah the prophet or Isaiah the prophet, and so on and so on. You get Psalms, which are liturgical poems from thousands of years ago. You have Proverbs. You have some scrolls that are read once a year. So there's something called Megillat Esther, the Scroll of Esther, which is read on Purim about Queen Esther and her cousin or uncle, Mordechai, and how the two of them together saved the Jews of Persia from genocide by Haman. So that's one of the scrolls that comes towards the end of the Hebrew Bible. So when we say Torah, it could be the specifically first five books. And generally speaking, if somebody uses the word Torah and they don't go much beyond that, that's likely to be what they're referring to. But it could refer to the entirety of the Hebrew Bible. It could also refer to the, there's something called oral Torah. We all do, but we call
it,
yeah.
In the cycle of the year, does it go to Joshua or does it go further?
It does in the sense that there's two biblical readings on the Shabbat service. One biblical reading comes from the Torah scroll, the first five books, and the second is called the Haftarah. Haftarah actually has nothing to do with the word Torah. Haftarah means additional, and it's an additional reading, and it comes from the second part of the Hebrew Bible, which includes Joshua. So Joshua, if my memory serves right, it's on Simchat Torah that way to show that the story continues even though the Torah scroll comes to a conclusion.
So it's always on a yearly cycle.
Yeah, yeah. A few thousand years ago, there was something called the triennial cycle, which has largely disappeared. You hear about triennial cycles now, but they mean something different. A couple thousand years ago, what the triennial cycle meant was they would take 3 years to read the entire Torah scroll. So they would start with Genesis 1 year, and 3 years later, they would finish Deuteronomy. Some synagogues, and most of the Reform movement in this country, are on what's called the triennial cycle, but they mean something different. They'll divide the Torah scroll up into weekly portions so that you do one portion from Genesis all the way through Deuteronomy at the end of a single year, but you'll only read a third of any Torah portion. So the first year you'll read the first third of the Torah portion, the second year you'll read the second third, and the last year, but you're still on basically a one-year cycle, not a three-year cycle. Or it's a blend between the two. It's not a pure triennial cycle like they used to have a couple thousand years ago. There's something called the Oral Torah. So there was no notion of an Oral Torah, at least nothing that we know about, until not quite 2,000 years ago. But all of a sudden, other Jewish traditions started to pop up. And over time, those Jewish traditions included things like synagogues, Shabbat candles, bar mitzvah, rabbis, Passover seders, a lot of things that we think of as pretty essential, understanding Rosh Hashanah to be the Jewish New Year. It was always declared a holy day, but it wasn't necessarily thought of in those terms. So all these different things grew up over time and are not in the first five books of the Bible, nor are they in anywhere in the Hebrew Bible, really. So where did they come from? Well, rabbis would say there's something called an oral Torah. And the way that the story went was Moses went up to Mount Sinai 7 weeks after everyone left Egypt. Moses went up Mount Sinai, and there's differing accounts. Some say he received the Ten Commandments, some say he received the Torah scroll, but one account says he received both the written Torah scroll, and then God also explained everything to him. And that explanation is the oral Torah. Because it's called oral, it gives you an idea that it was given orally to Moses and preserved orally, passed down from Moses to Joshua, Joshua down through the generations. And then about 2,000 years ago, which would have been 1,000 plus years after Moses would have lived, people started to write it down because they were worried that they were going to forget it. And they wrote down little bits at a time. But it's all considered part of Torah with the same or similar roots to the written scroll.
Many people write.
We know who the editors were. So Judah Hanasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, he compiled the very first rabbinic writings. That was around the year 220 of the Common Era, so not 2,000 years ago. And then there were various compilations after that, and each generation was basically saying, there's more to it than what the previous generation wrote down. They didn't commit it all to writing, so we're just going to write down a little bit more. Did it actually happen that way? From my point of view, likely not. Part of progressive Judaism is understanding that religion progresses over time, that religion grows organically.
The perception of at the time.
Yeah, but also religious authority is also many times based on the older the tradition, the more authentic the tradition, and the more important the tradition. So sometimes the devout will say our practices have origins going back to Moses. It's a way to give some legitimacy to what it is that people are doing. That being said, a lot of the rabbis knew that what they were doing was creating something new. And even when you read this oral Torah that supposedly came down from Moses, you'll see this is a rabbinic decree, or this law is a law of the rabbis, rather than saying this is a law of the written Torah or a law of the Hebrew Bible. Yeah. So if you were, this is an introduction class, we're not going to get too much into jurisprudence, but there were considered to be two types of laws, one called De Oraita, which is biblical law and the other called Derabbanan, which is rabbinic law. Anytime a rabbi is saying a law is Derabbanan, they know for sure that it doesn't go all the way back to Moses, and they're pretty much admitting it by calling it Derabbanan. What they might say is we're legislating for new circumstances based on old values, something like that, okay? So oral Torah, so there's entire libraries. The most expansive understanding of oral Torah is that anything that Jews have written down that's made its way into Jewish life could be considered part of an oral Torah. You could go to West London Synagogue and the sermon given on Shabbat by whatever rabbi there, or any synagogue in the world, would be considered Torah. The interpretation of Torah is itself Torah. So, because the word is teaching, and it just gives a little bit of importance to the status of Jewish learning, right? Okay? So, one of the things that we'll be doing as we go over the week is we'll talk about pretty much both the first five books, what's in it, what are the values, what are the stories, because those stories tend to be referred back to all the time. So, who are the main people? So, Adam and Eve were the first two, but there's a lot of other important people there also. Cain and Abel, their sons, the first Jewish people, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, Rachel, Leah, the 12 sons that came from them that founded the tribes of Israel, Dina, their daughter, who gets scant mention but has an important story of her own, who was Moses, who was his brother Aaron, who was their sister Miriam, and so on and so on. So the stories are just as important as the laws, and the laws are found in there too. Some of the laws are familiar to people because they include the Ten Commandments. Don't murder, don't steal. And when a lot of this was written years ago, this was actually meant to be a functioning legal system for a society, the same way British law is for Britain. It wasn't simply religious law freely accepted by the people. The notion was this is actually a legal system and we need people to judge and we need people to enforce. Shoftim and Shotrim, they would call them. The Shoftim would be the judges, the Shotrim would be the officers of the law. Police, I guess, would be the modern equivalent, although it's a little different. So it was meant to be a fully functioning legal system, not just what we would consider ritual law, but also criminal law, civil law. The Hebrew Bible contains it all, or touches on each of those subjects. We'll also talk about some of the rest of the Hebrew Bible because there's some important figures in there too. King David, King Solomon, some of the prophets, some prophetic teachings. Particularly in the Reform world, those prophets have been emphasized to an even greater importance in the Reform world because the early Reform Jews in the 19th century, some of them like to refer to Reform Judaism as prophetic Judaism. And what they were referring to was the teachings of the prophets in the second half of the Hebrew Bible. Prophets that they saw emphasized ethical teachings over ritual. So you have some prophets pretty much chastising ancient Israelites for fasting to win God's favor and then thinking that that means something in and of itself, and that if you don't also take care of poor people, if you don't also take care of people on the margins, orphans, widows, what have you, you're really not doing anything worthwhile at all. So to kind of emphasize the ethics over and above the ritual. Not to do away with the ritual, but to emphasize one over the other. So we'll be talking about some of the prophets. We'll also talk about an introduction to the Jewish library, because that's everything else. And the rest of the Jewish library is important. So if you hear people say, quote the Talmud, you'll know what the Talmud is. If you hear people quote Mishnah, you'll know what Mishnah is. Or Midrash, you'll know what Midrash is. We're not going to go through it all because it'll take a lifetime. And you might end up with rabbinic ordination if you get through it all.
Can I ask you a question about the Talmud?
Yeah.
There's the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud.
Yeah.
When someone says Talmud, do they just refer
Babylonian.
To Babylonian.
So there's two, when the word Talmud, it's another word for teaching. It comes from the word lilmod, which means to study. There's two Talmuds. They're both considered the major central work of the classic rabbis going back 1,000 plus years. That being said, one of them is much larger and more authoritative than the other, and it's the Babylonian Talmud that's much larger, much more authoritative, and was finished later than the Jerusalem Talmud. So if you hear people say the Talmud says, most likely what they're referring to is the Babylonian Talmud. If they're talking about the other Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, they'll say the Jerusalem Talmud, or Hebrew Talmud Yerushalmi, or sometimes you'll hear it called the Palestinian Talmud, because it was written in Israel. It was not written in Jerusalem, actually. It was put together in the north of Israel. The other one, the Babylonian Talmud, from where it was put together, or Talmud Bavli. Okay, so we'll go through all that, some of the major works. That'll be covered over the entirety of the course. Israel. This is a nice generic term for the people Israel. So obviously we'll be covering the belief and we'll be covering the teaching, but then there's also the loose understanding of culture and history and language, and that all goes together. So knowing something about the history. At Shabbat services yesterday morning, I told the story about how when I first started rabbinic school, very first lesson, very first day, the dean of the campus said, the most important thing for anyone to understand here is history, because everything has a historical context. And this was at a reformer rabbinic school. I would say, actually, that's a pretty fair point, that if you really want to get to an understanding of why the Torah says this or why a rabbi said that, you need to understand the context in which it was said. And that's history. Being part of the Jewish people is being part of an unfolding story. So knowing something about the history. How is it the Jews ended up in England? How is it that in the Torah, we know that they started somewhere east, the family started somewhere east of Israel, so the Middle East, made its way to Israel. The story pretty much ends with everyone in Israel slightly scattered at certain points because of exiles and whatever. But to make their way all the way to England, that's a pretty far ways from where the Bible leaves us off. So how is it the Jewish life came to be in England? What's Jewish life like in England? And a lot of that is the study of history. Same thing. The word is diaspora. A lot of communities have diasporas, but dispersions. People spread out from their original location. So history also, I would say, we'll touch a little bit on history generally over the course of the intro course. So ancient history, medieval history, which is all important. We'll spend a bit of disproportionate time on modern history because that'll help us to understand how it is that we got to where we are today. So it'll be, like I said, the foundings and developments of British Jewish communities. It'll also be two of the most significant events in Jewish history happened in the 20th century, meaning the Holocaust and the establishment of the State of Israel. So we'll be spending some time on the Holocaust and anti-Semitism that predates the Holocaust that led up to it. How is it that such a thing was possible and what did it mean? And also a little bit of post-Holocaust, how did the Holocaust affect life for Jews after the Holocaust? And the establishment of the State of Israel. Jews for about 2,000 years were not in control of any land whatsoever. They were always a religious minority, wherever they happened to be, because they were spread out. So 2,000 years, that, to my knowledge, there's no other country that existed 2,000 years ago that was put together. And it's not just the country with a loose connection to the past. They pretty much revived the language as well, the Hebrew language, as a living language. So they call those modern-day miracles. You can make your own judge, but we'll at least learn the history of Zionism and whatnot. It didn't just happen by chance. So there's decades and decades worth of work and energy put into establishing, and several wars since then as well, that went into establishing the State of Israel. And today, not quite half of Jewish people worldwide live in Israel. So studying Israel a little bit gives us some important insight into what it means to be Jewish, especially because nearly half of all Jews worldwide live there today. Okay, how we do? Questions?
I can't think of any right now, but I'm going to digest it for the rest of the day, everything you've gone through. I might even listen to the recording again, actually, because it's quite good to go over things.
Yeah. Reminds me, I'm going to just make sure it's still going, because it's stopped in the middle of last time and not too much middle, actually, pretty early, so I just want to make sure. Good. Okay. Is there anything in particular that either of you are hoping to get out of the course so that I make sure that I cover it? It doesn't have to be a quick question now, that, but maybe an entire subject that you're hoping to get out of this course.
When I say general, I don't mean it to sound insignificant, but the whole lot of what you've just gone through really is the whole, you know, the history and everything like that.
So yeah.
I haven't got anything particular to ask.
Okay, yeah. That's fine.
I think these three are good places to start.
Yeah.
And then I'm sure we'll just bring up lots and lots of questions.
Yeah, perfect.
That's fine.
Yeah. So, okay. I'll tell you what, why don't we start with Torah? Because it's 10:30 now, so we've still got a little bit of time. So the reason why I'm not starting with God is not because God's not important, but the way I sometimes, in this setting, to teach about God is almost to have a conversation with historical figures about what they believed in God, how they came to that belief, what that belief meant to them. Of course, people are free to have whatever belief they want taking the class and add to it, but it's the best way I know how to teach God. But that also means first introducing Torah so you understand what the sources are. Same thing with Israel, because Torah is essentially our source material. The entirety of Torah, not just the first five books. Definitely those first five books, but the entirety. Okay, so God's important, but we'll come back to God. And we might hit God as we talk about some of the others as well. Okay, but we'll start with Torah. Sometimes when I teach the class, I say, does anyone know what language the Hebrew Bible was written in? And occasionally it takes a few minutes before somebody says Hebrew. But that's important to know, because when learning about Torah, I'm not saying you have to know Hebrew, but it's helpful to at least engage in some way with the Hebrew. That could be with a teacher who's familiar with the Hebrew. That could be with commentaries that engage with the Hebrew. Because anytime you're going through a translation, essentially what you're doing is looking at somebody's best guess at what different things mean, but what they might not tell you is that that guess is not always certain, or even if the translator is certain, that's not to say that there's not been a significant amount of debate over what something actually means. And at best, any translation is finding a synonym in another language, and synonyms are never exact meanings. So sometimes words have alternative meanings in a given language, and when you're reading something in the original language, you have a choice between those different meanings. And if you pick one of those meanings and you translate, you might not have a word in the different language that encompasses all the different meanings. So let's see, let me give you an example in English. So say that somebody's rich. Perhaps the first thing that might come to your mind is money. They have a lot of money. But the word is rich enough in the English language that I just used in a completely different context that made sense. To say that a word is rich doesn't necessarily mean that a word has money. It means that the word could be used in a variety of different ways and has a lot of different subtleties to it. A person might say that they're rich because they have everything that they want, even if that's not a lot of money. I once heard that the Alaskan Eskimos have however many dozens of words for snow. Hebrew has one. The word love in English can mean a lot of different things. It could mean romantic love, which is one sort of love. It could mean the love of a parent for a child. A person could also speak of their love for humanity, and that's definitely not that sort of intimate notion of love that's either parent-child or romantic, and so on and so on. So that word love in the English language could mean a lot of different things. Hebrew, also, different words mean different things. So that's something to think about. In addition, there's in the written Torah, there's no vowels and there's no punctuation. Because there's no vowels and no punctuation, it's sometimes doubly difficult or triply difficult to figure out what exactly is being said. because there's no punctuation, you don't know if you're supposed to end a phrase. One, you're not necessarily sure where you're supposed to end the phrase, but even if you were sure where you're supposed to end the phrase, if you were to punctuate it, would you put a question mark at the end? Would you put a full stop at the end? Would you put a comma there and then tie it in as just one sentence that's modifying the phrase that comes after it? We're pretty sure that do not murder is a full stop or even an exclamation mark at the end.
Why is it written that way?
In the development of written language, it precedes punctuation. Punctuation's an invention, just like the alphabet's an invention. In fact, some people say that one of the reasons why the Hebrew Bible might have become so popular in the world is because the alphabet was contained. So, for example, ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics, there's, I don't know, how many thousands of different symbols, and you almost needed something like a university degree in order to be able to read because there's so many thousands of different symbols to learn. With Hebrew, you have the benefit of a contained alphabet, so you only need to learn a couple dozen symbols. And for the first time, there's not vowels, but there's quasi-vowels. So there's the letter Y, or the equivalent of the letter Y. And just like in English, where Y is sometimes a consonant and sometimes a vowel, same thing in Hebrew, sometimes a consonant, sometimes a vowel. Same thing with, it's just an up and down line. It could be the letter V, which is a consonant, but it could also be O or U, meaning it could be pronounced either O or U, which is a vowel sound. So it's one of the first languages that had something akin to a vowel written down with contained letters that could be put together in different formats in order to form a word. So, in fact, oddly enough, God has a personal name in the Hebrew Bible, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. So if you ever heard of Jehovah's Witnesses, that's a mispronunciation of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. But it looks like this. Y-H-V-H, but that V could also be an O or a U, remember. It's almost like God's name is made out of the closest thing Hebrew has to vowels. That level of, that time period of Hebrew. So they were so thrilled with having vowels that they put them together in different formats. Or the closest thing to a vowel, they're not technically vowel. I mean, an H is a consonant, but vowels with, you know, a breath put together. Okay, so the reason I'm telling you that is because when we learn Torah, nothing's obvious. There was a movement in Christianity called fundamentalism. And nowadays, a lot of Christians are, I think, unfairly called fundamentalists. But it meant one specific thing, which is you go back to the fundamental readings of the Bible, and it's plain and it's simple, and anybody can understand it, and you don't need a teacher. And the whole point of it was to be simple. Jews would come along and say there's no such thing, that's silly. Because the very first word in the Hebrew Bible has a start, you can tell me in English. Has the Bible start?
In the beginning.
In the beginning, yeah. Hey, even though, excellent. In the beginning. Dot. I'm going to work in the Hebrew though. So in Hebrew, excellent, Bereshit. So that's a bet. Bereshit, which means in the beginning. There is a problem with the very first word of the Hebrew Bible. And the problem is that this word, which we always translate in the beginning, actually means in the beginning of. The Hebrew word does not mean in the beginning, it means in the beginning of. This bet means in, Rosh, it's like Rosh Hashanah, which is head of the year, so at the head of or in the start of. And then this Taf over here is of. You didn't know you were going to get the Hebrew grammar lesson today. Anytime you have the word of, one would expect a noun to come after it. In the beginning of creation, in the beginning of time, in the beginning of the world, whatever that noun would be, it would be a noun. The problem is, in Hebrew, after Bereshit, the second word of the Hebrew Bible. I'd be impressed. Do you know the second word? The second word is bara, which means created. Hebrew word, past tense, created. In the beginning of created, Bereshit bara Elohim, in the beginning of created God, et hashamayim ve'et haaretz, the heavens and the earth. So what's the problem? We have this word of, we're missing a word. You wouldn't know that unless you knew a little something about Hebrew grammar or you read a commentary written by somebody who's aware of the problem. This is not a 20th or 21st century grammarian who first noticed it. This is something that's been written about for well over 1,000 years by linguists who have really tried to engage with the Hebrew language of the text. And they're all grappling with the fact that the Hebrew Bible begins with what appears to be a mistake. You know, if you were writing a book or you were writing anything that you expected people to read, you would want to proofread it, and especially the very first word, you'd want to make sure that you got off to a good start. There's a commentator named Rashi. He's considered to be the most important Jewish author on the first 5 books of the Hebrew Bible. He lived not quite 1,000 years ago, a little bit less, and he lived in France. And his understanding of this was that it probably should have started with Berishono, which would have been pretty much translated in the beginning, but without the grammatical difficulties. So why start the text with difficulties? Well, there's no satisfying answer that I have to give you except to say that it's been written about forever. Except to say that I see it as a way to, as an invitation to invite discussion over the Torah. Because the discussion, the learning of Torah is done by debate. It's done by being unafraid to offer certain ideas that might not necessarily just that might be seen as arguing with the text, but not really arguing with the text, but grappling with its difficulty and admitting that there's difficulty and admitting that you might have something to say and somebody else might have something to say, and there's not an easy answer that's going to be forced upon everybody. A Jewish method of studying the Torah is all about questioning, and it's all about discussion, it's all about debate. It's never about, this is what this means, go learn it. What we would say is go learn what other people had to say, not so that you had to accept what they had to say, but simply so that one could be in the conversation and to be educated about that conversation. So I suppose academic freedom, that would be the modern equivalent of it, or freedom of speech, I don't know. But if you really wanted a deep understanding of it, you need to admit that nothing is clear, or at least some things aren't clear. Some things might be clear. I think do not murder is pretty clear, but some things are not necessarily clear, and because of that, it's okay.
Will I be right if I say the presentation is mostly deeply philosophical than just obvious?
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is, like you say, it is not that clear when you're studying it or when you're reading it. You have to discuss, you have to debate, you have to question. Like, it is not just like on the face value, like, you know, this thing is like this, okay, this is like blue, and then that's it, something like that.
Yeah.
Is it what you mean?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's also, one of the things that's open to discussion is what genre of literature are we reading? So, for example, when you're reading Torah, are you reading, it's usually pretty clear if you're reading legal literature because it tells you do this, don't do that, the consequence of not doing this or that is X.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're reading a story like this, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Is this meant to be a history of the universe? And you have people give all sorts of answers to it. And even then, you can break down the question further. Do we want to read it as a history? And was it written with the intention by the author that this is a history? Other alternatives could be is that this is more akin to a fable. So the ancient world knew what fables were. Aesop wrote a bunch of fables. Was there actually a race between a tortoise and a hare with a nice lesson at the end? The tortoise raced the hare, the tortoise beat the rabbit in a race because the rabbit got all the way just before the finish line and took a nap, and the tortoise just kept going, so they say slow and steady wins the race. No. The ancient world also had stories that they told to teach a lesson, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the story was true. The moral of the story was important, but did the actual story wasn't intended by the author to say that this was true. So there have been arguments made that the story of the creation of the world was not meant to be taken literally. It was meant to say that there's one creator. It was meant to say that all of humanity has shared origins. So one family's not better than the other, and there's equality between different people, and so on and so on. All these different lessons that could be taught. You could look at Adam and say, Adam was generic man, or Eve was generic woman, and really get into the two of these people and say, what does it mean to be a human? And you could study human nature by looking at Adam and Eve, because they're the template for all of humanity. So all sorts of reasons to want to read the account of creation, which don't necessarily mean that you have to accept that the world is 5,700, almost 78 years old, created in 6 days, and so on and so on. So you could still say Charles Darwin has a lot to teach us about the origins of species, and you could or evolutionary biology that developed from his research. And you could take a class in astronomy, and it doesn't necessarily contradict what you read in the Hebrew Bible, because they're actually getting at something different. How you choose to read it and what you believe the original intention of the author is, like I said, that could be a debate. There's still debate today over what the original intention of the author was. At least in terms of the intention of a reader, for me personally, I don't read it as being a history. I'd like to think it wasn't intended to be a history. The field of history as we know it today didn't even exist back then. But I don't know for sure what the original intention of the author was. But despite the intention of the author, I can at least say I still have something that I can take from it, even if I'm not sold on the idea that the world was created in 6 days, however many thousands of years ago. One teacher of mine said the question's not is the story true, it's what truths are to be found within the story. And I think there's still a lot of relevant moral and theological points made in the story of creation that have nothing to do with the historicity of it all. Okay? Okay, we've got 5 more minutes. So let's stick to this very first verse of Torah. If the Hebrew Bible were written in English, it would start like this. No punctuation, no vowels. It's not written in English. This is just meant to illustrate. What's the first word?
In.
Okay. Could be an I. All you have is the letter N, though. What else could it be? You get to add any vowel you want. Yeah. Could be no. Could make the whole thing negative, right? In the beginning, God did not create the heavens and the earth. What else could it be? The way you make something negative in Hebrew, by the way, it's pretty much the same word, lo. Lo means no, but it could also be not. It could make You could just insert it into the entire sentence to flip the meaning of it, to either say something is or something isn't. So in, could be no. What else? You get to add any vowel you want to the one letter N. Could be on, right?
Yeah.
You could add a vowel on either end. Could be one. It's Hebrew. It's a little clearer in the Hebrew. It says in or at. In and at are the same in Hebrew. It's the letter bet before a word. But you can see that just by changing the vowels in English, you can change the meaning of a word entirely. Same thing in Hebrew. It's not always clear what the vocalization is supposed to be. It's usually predictable, 99% of the time. The question is that 1% of the time when you could vocalize something multiple different ways, and depending upon how you vocalize it, it might be a little bit different. That also goes to that point I made earlier about Bereshit in the beginning of how that invites commentary. This does too, disagreement. For example, I'll give you one word that could be vocalized one of two ways and it means the same thing. Banim and bonim. One means children or sons in particular. The other means builders. Two completely different words. Builders and children, spelled the same way. Bonim, banim. There's been all sorts of sermons based on that about how they're actually the same thing, that your children build your future. But that was a nice little play that the different people have come up with, most popularly taught by Franz Rosenzweig, who's a 20th century philosopher. But because words could mean different things but spelled the same way, we have that in English too, the same word that means multiple different things, homonyms. But it also means that there's a lot of discussion and debate over Torah. When you pick up a Jewish Torah commentary, there's usually multiple different viewpoints presented. The classic commentary is called the Rabbinic Bible, and they'll have a little piece of text in the middle from the Torah, from the written Torah, maybe a verse from Genesis or whatever, and then they'll have this rabbi from France said this, this rabbi from Spain said this, that rabbi from France, well, his grandson said this over here, and he didn't like what his grandfather said, so he said something different. This Sephardic rabbi said that, that Ashkenazi rabbi said this, and they'll surround the page and there'll be differences of opinion. And that's considered kind of the golden standard of a Jewish commentary, is to present different ideas because you're entering into a discussion and it's meant to be a learned discussion, opening oneself up to the possibilities, to the richness of the text. So that's Torah. Next time what I want to do, I want to continue to delve into Torah, but I really want to look at some specific personalities and stories. Really get into who were the people in the Bible, because those people are still talked about today, and sometimes they're used as models, sometimes they're used as, or role models, I should say. Sometimes the stories that they're in really laid the groundwork for values and practices that are still here to this day. So we'll do that next time. Anyways, we're done for today.
Thanks.
And great seeing everyone. Take care.